we have been considering during the last few meetings about the liberation of the instruments, liberation of the spirit. Today we take up the question of the liberation of nature. All life is a series of interactions between nature, the experience presented by nature, and its acceptance by the soul, by the self. The level on which this interaction takes place determines the level of the quality of life. Normally, nature, we have seen, is constituted of three modes, what we call the gunas. These three gunas, the guna of tamas, inertia, indolence, immobility, of rajas, kinesis, drive, push, sattva, enlightenment, calm, a certain order and control, these in their interaction constitute the action of nature. And the continuous action of these three modes leads to a character of duality. Opposites characterizing our relations with life. Opposites of pain and pleasure, good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant, and so on. The aim before us when we speak of the liberation of nature is that one should achieve a freedom from the action of the gunas, from the impact and the action of the dualities. That is what the Gita says. That is what all yogic tradition demands of us. But there are two kinds of liberation. The traditional spiritual conception of this liberation is that you withdraw from nature, keep yourself aloof as far as possible from involvement, start with indifference and gradually detach yourself, not to participate as much as possible in the play of the gunas, in the interaction of the dualities. And by this detachment, one acquires a poise by which one can gradually merge either in the silence of Brahman or the bliss. But this is an incomplete liberation. The true liberation of nature can arise only when one acquires mastery over the functioning of the guna and the play of dualities. One has to acquire control over nature, exert one's will upon nature, decide which guna is to have a play to negative which other guna. Exercise one's will to prevent oneself from playing into the hands of either of the opposites called dualities. In other words, we must not only release the soul from the action of the three modes of nature upon it, but uplift our soul, our inner being, so that it exerts its will element on nature, so that it can regulate the gunas and the play of dualities as it chooses. Freedom, as I said, is not an emptiness of gunas. If you detach yourself, keep yourself aloof, we may arrive at a state of a comparative emptiness of modes and gunas. But that is not liberation. It is a superiority to gunas that the Gita hints at, and the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo calls upon the seeker to achieve. Now, to come to more details, let us take the quality of tamas. Each of these qualities acts upon each of our levels of being. Though, broadly speaking, you can say that tamas, inertia, is a characteristic quality of our physical, material being, material nature. Rajas, kinesis, is characteristic of our life nature. And sattva, calm enlightenment, is characteristic of the mind. But this is only for sake of certain clarification of concepts. But man is a multiple being, all parts interacting, interpenetrating into each other. So the tamas not only acts in the physical material nature, making it inert, lazy, resistant to change, resistant to movement, but it also casts its shadow on the life force, dragging it down, making it heavy. It also reaches the mind and prevents it from adventuring into new ideas, new dimensions of concepts, holds it back. It makes it stick to its previous opinions, past concepts, resistant to new winds of change. Similarly with emotions. We have got all old samskaras. We are accustomed to react to situations in a particular way by habit. Now it is the tamasic element in nature that recalls those past habits and pulls us back to the old grooves each time we want to give a different reaction. So also at the aesthetic level, at the emotional level, at every level of our consciousness, the role of tamas is to hold back, to drag you down, to prevent an advance either upwards or forwards. That is, there is an inertia not only of the physical being, but an inertia, that inertia of force, an inertia of knowledge. So also, the rajas, which is supposed to be a vital quality, actually, it may be a characteristic quality of life force, but it is not confined to it. When the rajasic element drives the body, the material nature, the inertia is put back, and the body shares in that impulse, maybe a desire-ridden impulsion of life force, cooperates with it excellently. The body may appear to be restless till it acclimatizes itself to the new temperature of rajas. Either way, the body also participates in the rajasic movement. And that is how one can make a clean departure from the old habits of the physical body by imposing upon it something of the drive, the force of rajas from the life level. So too in the mind, when the rajas acts in the mind is always eager to make more conquests, to know more things, maybe on the motive, some motive of acquiring domination or whatever it is, but still the mental movement is quickened. So it is one of the tactics of the old yogas to learn to balance one preponderating quality with another. If we are traditionally tamasic, we should learn to activize our rajasic nature and direct the rajasic force in those areas of our being where tamas predominates. Now, if rajas alone were to predominate, man would never know where he is going to be tomorrow. One loses control, one places oneself in the control of the rajasic force. There comes in the sattva, the element or the quality of calm, of certain equality, of having a certain ordered control. Now that element is not peculiar to the mind alone. As one practices the inner discipline, one knows that the life force also, however impetuous it is, if we can impose a certain order, base it upon a quiet and a calm, undisturbed poise, there is an immediate gathering of that force. The force does not spill itself immediately at the first provocation. The force is gathered, waits for the signal. That is how the impulsive nature of the rajasic force is brought under control by the exercise of the sattvic guna. So too in the body, which is gross or maybe too rajasic, if the sattvic element is increased, the whole metabolism of the physical body undergoes a change. It is by increasing or decreasing the play of these gunas in the body that changes in the functioning, different kinds of functionings can be brought out. Whether the modern scientists have got instruments to discover these things, I am not sure. They have devised instruments to measure heartbeats, brain vibrations, when people are supposed to go into meditation, into concentration, into japa. But whether in this manipulation of the qualities of the guna and the resultant changes in the activities of the system, maybe blood circulation, maybe life circulation of nerve force, these, whether they can be measured, that is a subject that the parapsychologists or the scientists have to think about. Now, for sake of clarification, for sake of study, we have spoken of these three gunas as if they are distinct. But nowhere on earth can these gunas be seen to be acting on their, in their independent roles, independent fields. There is always a mingling of gunas. In the same person, the nature of the mingling may vary from time to time, from situation to situation, from level to level of his growth. The one result of this mingling of the gunas is that there is always a multiple action, calling for a multiple attention. The very nature of life is that these gunas are in a state of disequilibrium. If all the gunas are in a state of equilibrium, there will be no movement. Who disturbed the original equilibrium and set the whole thing process going? The philosophers are not agreed. The Sankhyas and the other older philosophies differ on this point, and it is not part of our philosophy, because we do not consider that the whole creation started with the disturbance of the gunas. It is a Sankhyan philosophy. Maybe this disturbance of the gunas is one of the processes at a lower level, at the level of Prakriti, nature, physical earth nature. But creation in Sri Aurobindo's conception starts in the Gnostic level, the supramental level, with the real idea. Granted that we try the ethical disciplines, the spiritual disciplines so far, and bring about a certain balance, and try to make the working of the gunas as perfect as possible, we can achieve only a relative perfection, because our mind continues to be in the shadow of ignorance. The vital and the physical continue to be dragged down by the inconscient or the nations. Each combination of the gunas that we overcome, more combinations are presented to us. And the linchpin of the action of the gunas is egoism. And ego, as we have discussed so often, is of many kinds. There is an ego of the physical kind, which gives the body, the physical body, the conviction that it is separate from others, that its own aim, claims are superior to the claims of other parts of the being. The very solidity of the physical body, the claims of physical desire, physical hunger, all these are organized and articulated through the physical ego. So also there is the ego of the rajas, the life force, the vital ego, of which everybody knows. There is the mental ego, that my ideas are correct, my knowledge is true, and everybody must conform to my pattern of thinking. I know this is a mental ego, and there are other egos, the ethical ego, aesthetic ego, even the spiritual ego. The point is, ego is a very ubiquitous element. It presents itself in different forms and different levels. And wherever it is, some touch of the guna is there. The gunas function through the instrumentality of the ego. And the way out of this octopus hold of ego is not by withdrawal. When you withdraw, the ego may get weak, but it continues. But by transcendence. We put it behind. We put it below us. And build up our true being. Make it an active being without functioning through the mold of the ego. It is an ordinary notion of people that if the ego is not there, no action is possible. But this again is an illusion created by the ego. Actually, an action based upon ego is a very limited and an imperfect action. If we can manage to dissociate our action from its source in the ego, from its cause in a desire motive, action ceases to be personal. Action takes on the character of universal nature, and it becomes more dynamic, more liberative. Action under the stamp of ego becomes a bondage. Action above or freed from the tentacles of ego, it is a liberative force. That is the first step. As we advance in yoga, as we build up new tiers of consciousness, we begin to see that the three gunas, rajas, tamas and sattva, as they appear to us, they are not the final qualities. They appear to us as they are because they are reflections in our lower nature of ignorance. As everything in our creation, everything is a reflection or a projection of something else in the higher nature. So these three gunas also are reflections or projections of some truths in the divine being above. Necessarily, when those truths are projected in our sphere, they undergo a certain deformation. But their truth continues to be there whether it is active here or not. As we evolve in our consciousness, we see that what is considered as a force of inertia, immobility, is truly a refraction, a deformation of the force or quality of peace of solidity, immutability, of shanti in the divine being. Similarly, the rajas, the restless force, is a transformation, in our terms, of the divine will to achieve, to conquer, to effectuate. Sattva, the calm poise that we achieve, the equality which we build up, these are all pale reflections of a light. The prakasha, as they say, of sattva is derived from a jyoti, radiance, the supreme light of knowledge, of consciousness in the divine being. As we grow in our consciousness, these very gunas begin to change their character. We realize in our states of concentration or meditation or trance, or in states, happy states of communion with the divine consciousness or the divine teacher, that behind these external appearances of the gunas in ignorance, there are truths which are accessible to us. But we cannot attain them as long as we are in mental ignorance. We have to go beyond the belt of mind, the ignorant mind, and cross into the Gnostic belt for the ultimate pattern to emerge. Till then, intermittently, we see the increasing change of sattva, rajas, tamas into their counterparts in the higher being, the higher nature. This reaches a high level of perfection only when we attain to the Gnostic level. As the gunas are realized to be the counterparts of higher truths in the divine being, the hold of dualities based upon these gunas also lessens. There is a liberation from reactions to situations where these dualities present themselves. Here also, the discipline starts first with a certain dispassion, a dispassion, say, for pleasure, for happiness, for joy, because one knows that where there is joy, there is grief. Where there is good, there is evil. So one becomes indifferent. One starts with a willed dispassion. One doesn't take interest in these things. One doesn't take interest in responding to these contacts, however pleasant they may appear. What Shivananda calls a liberative dispassion. This leads to a confirmed indifference, udasina. You sit above the flow of these dualities, watching them, but without being affected by them. And the third step, first is dispassion, second is indifference, third is mastery. So whether the dualities that come are in the form of pleasure and pain, or good and evil, suffering and joy, there is a certain mastery in our reaction. We take and respond to the situation in the right way, pain does not make an impact of pain, pleasure does not make an impact of the normal pleasure. From both, the soul draws the right rasa of things, the right sap. Here too, as in the guna, rejection is not liberation. Rejection of the dualities can only be a first step. It has to be proceeded upon. Rejection, indifference, mastery. This is the formula for the liberation of nature, either in its aspect of the play of guna or in its aspect of the play of dualities.
In whatever work we do, if there is only well, a bit of ego, that work cannot be done with any enthusiasm. It becomes a matter of fact or a routine routine.
That is why the Gita says, and Sri Aurobindo speaks in the Yoga of Work, that every bit of work must be looked upon as you are offering to the Lord. Because ultimately, it is not your work, your energies that you are pouring. It is His energies, His power that is working. And you have to recognize that you are a chosen instrument. And when you consecrate and offer that work to the Master of Works, the glow that accompanies the performance of the work is much more liberative and joyous than any work that you can do on the drive of desire. These questions arise only to seekers, for people still in the realm or rounds of ignorance, they are not relevant. They have to be trained to make their desires more noble, less selfish. So they have to be trained through the gunas. Desire, yes, but a more noble desire. Altruistic, humanitarian. This is how the circle is expanded till the circle is so far extended that it just breaks and you lose yourself in the universal circle. It can't be a universal circle, universal being, universal being. We have seen, most of us before we have come here, we have worked. You have worked in offices, I have worked in some other places. In different ways. We have seen how we used to work. We would work for money, we would work for position, we would go to the office, do that work, come back, forget about it. But when you come and work here in the ashram, when we started working for Mother, could you escape the thrill of joy, that feeling of continuous progress in the being, how the whole atmosphere becomes solemn when you start work in the ashram, in the right spirit. Here there is no question of desire, because there is no return, monetary return, material return, neither position or anything. But still, the setting of the work, that the work is looked upon as an offering to the divine, that makes a capital difference. And the quality of work has been found, in case of seekers, to be vastly superior to the work that they themselves have been doing before they started yoga. So this is what has been achieved in the ashram and shown for years and years together, say till about 20 years ago. This should explode the myth that man will work only on economic motive. Only desire can make man work. The society can only be economic, based on economics. That society can be based on love. Society can be based on interchange and harmony, on cooperative basis, voluntarily cooperative and not on competitive basis. It is only here that it has been demonstrated, at any rate in the first 30 years. And it is that idea which Mother wanted to project in Auroville, without the scaffolding that was necessary in the ashram. Scaffolding in the sense preventing interchange with the lower levels of life outside, with different elements who are not wedded to this ideal and all that. But once that was achieved, once she was certain that the earth consciousness is ready for this kind of new life, she thought that now is the time to project the fruit of this work for the last 3 decades or 4 decades in Auroville on a larger canvas. Whether that idea is being worked out in the proper that spirit here or not, the idea has been taken up in various other places and people are working out and encouraging results are being reported. Humanity is ready today. They may or may not subscribe to the philosophies of Sri Aurobindo and Mother, but broadly the principle that the economic base, the ego base, the economic base of society, the ego base of individual, they are all relics of the past. Man is moving towards a different future where he is going to base himself on different values, that is today accepted by the higher mind of humanity all over the world. They may give different names, but these are different experiments. And we have been given the privilege of being the pioneers, but whether we deserve it, we justify it or not, the experiment is on, and there is no going back upon it.
In American first part of the answer, Mother has said that a sannyasi is more attached to his robes than a householder to his wife. In what context?
A householder being attached to his wealth, to his home, is understandable because he frankly accepts his limitations and the round of ignorance, he functions in it, and you can expect of him only those reactions which a person in ignorance can give. But a sannyasi, a person, a recluse who claims to have left behind this realm of ignorance, to have arisen above desire and things. New standards are applied to him. He can't expect to justify himself in the old ways. If he expects a higher recognition, a higher standard is imposed upon him. But what happens? The old nature continues, and the very fact that he has divested himself of other interests, that egoism, that desire, concentrates itself terribly upon the little area that is still left to him. There are not too many interests where his egoism and desire can be distributed so as not to be too, obtrusive. But when there are limited things, the whole thing is concentrated upon it. And it is true what Mother said. She said that she had never seen people more unspiritual than these sannyasins. She meant general, right? The individuals, there are always exceptions. Because they will flare up. Always they have a feeling of superiority over you all people. I remember once in our office, one sannyasi came and he had a householder disciple, young fellow. So he said, we have come all the way and we want to stay for a few days. And I said, you don't have money? He said, no. I said, all right, we can have you as a guest for one or two days. No, I have got some disciples outside. Then he said, those people we can't help. Then he thought I didn't understand Hindi. So he told his disciples, these are all worldly people. And he walked away. And he was a sannyasi. See, they are as much attached, but inexcusably attached. What Mother said, that a vital ego, a mental ego, perhaps you can justify. But when you have a spiritual ego, it is inexcusable. Because when you are spiritual or you want to be spiritual, the first thing is ego should be given up. Spirituality can't be there where there is ego. So it is inexcusable. Like Sri Aurobindo makes fun somewhere of the self-righteousness of the moral man, how he is superior to other people, how other people are immoral and he is alone superior. He kills himself, he cancels himself. So here too, in our community, this feeling of being superior beings, elect, elite of the society, it is a thing to be got rid of. We have certainly not evolved to justify that appellation. Mother had hoped that we would. Some are stagnating, some are progressing, some are struggling. Yes?
You have an explanation that we regard ignorance as it come to us.
Yes.
That according to Mother and Srivabhani's teachings, that must be because the creation is trying to evolve towards a higher evolution of that.
This deformation is a part of the process of involution.
Right.
Involution, because what was Sat, Chit, Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, originally, when it plunged here for manifestation, it turned into, existence turned into non-existence, consciousness turned into nations, and delight turned into non-sentience. no feeling. Mm-hmm. All the other gunas, the peace, all these are parts of Sat Chit Ananda. They also turned into their opposites. So in the course of evolution, from the form that they have taken in the plunge, they have slowly to evolve back into their higher term.
Well, why? What is the gain? I mean, there must be some reason.
Sri Aurobindo explains this perennial question in the last chapter of The Riddle of the World. I think it was an answer to Maurice Magre, a French thinker. Sri Aurobindo says that it is difficult to give a mental answer to this question, why all this bother was necessary. He was happy there, existence, consciousness, bliss, everything was there. Why all this bother? Says, we can put it in mental terms this way. When, and it is a tradition, when the divine being, the supreme, is self-aware, contemplative, number of possibilities move round him. We sit, we think. Similarly, in his consciousness, there are many movements. So, at some time, there is no time or space there even. One possibility arises. Supposing a state is there where there is no existence, where there is no consciousness, where there is no bliss. Is it possible to manifest this, my being there? The possibility having arisen, it became a challenge. The idea having come, the possibility started. The possibility starting, immediately the thing goes forth, taking the wager, taking the challenge as it were. And the divine soul leaps to prove to itself that it can manifest. So a series of involutions, descents take place, by which the whole thing plunges and existence turns into its opposite, consciousness opposite, this thing opposite. Thereafter, the real work starts thereafter, when the divine soul starts asserting itself, pushing itself in front and evolving all those divine qualities or divine values, divine powers, which have come to establish and manifest themselves in conditions which are exactly the opposite. This is how Sri Aurobindo explains, we can say it is a game, it is a play. Some philosophers will say it is a play. Some philosophers will say the divine, after undergoing this adventure, the soul that goes, has this adventure and comes back, is infinitely richer in experience, infinitely richer in stature than the soul that left original.
Do you mind the analogy of the divine being going through the same processes that the human being goes through?
After all, human being, what is he? Human being also is a counterpart of the divine being.
Most
thoughts
that we have come from outside, and that
we
don't, that pure movement is
for the divine. There is no outside.
Yeah, then how can he do
that? In his own being. For us, we need not get thoughts outside. You see, we can get thoughts from within ourselves. It is possible. Some thoughts come from outside. For an ordinary ignorant man, 90% of the thoughts come from outside. As Chandra says, he doesn't think he is thought. But as one emanates one's own thoughts, one's own feelings.
Now
this is a mental explanation, what Sri Aurobindo says. This is the nearest explanation we can give. But it is difficult to give in mental terms the why of it.
But there's one point that's not clear, because if we have this pure creative thought, This is not in any way a deformation. It's those other things.
That's what Mother says. Mother says, from his angle it is not a deformation. From our angle, things are deformed. From his angle, things are just what they should be at the precise time. You see, Mother has said, do you remember? Things are exactly as they should be at any time, point of time. For us, looking from below, it looks things are bad, things have gone wrong, things are different. But for him who sees the whole process going on, like a smith seeing the iron, the fire undergoing many changes, he doesn't think that it has gone black. He knows after the black another color will come. So exactly things are following. For him there is no deformation. For him it is a process of manifestation. For us who have segmentary views, segmentary visions, all these problems arise. Once the consciousness stands above, there are no problems.